Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And so today we're going to tackle a couple of quick-fire topics in one of our semi-regular kind of Q&A. Please do keep on sending in questions or news stories or scientific studies or anything else you think would be good to discuss. The email address, as always, is molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And actually, I think you found this first, which is a study in some journal, I don't know which one, which is about AI friendship apps and their impact on the user's well-being and addiction. Do you want to just quickly summarize what this is all about and what they found?
Yes, I found this article called One is the Loneliest Number, the Influence of AI Friendship Apps on Users' Well-being and Addiction. And it looks to me like quite a well-constructed sort of social psychology research project, where the authors found a large number of people who were having, who were using a companion app called Replica, which is available via the internet, and you develop a personalized quotes companion on your smartphone that you can have constant interactions with. Some people are having as many as 100 interactions a day. And they studied all the comments made by several hundred of these active Replica users. And then they selected a smaller group for a very detailed, semi-structured questionnaire. So this is a kind of standard social psychology research project. And they drew out a whole series of themes, and they came up with four themes, which were as follows. The first, that AI friends make me feel less alone. Second, that AI friends are always there for me, unlike human friends. Third, this interesting thing that for many of the users, it seemed the fact that they didn't have a mind, they weren't real people, was both positive and negative. AI friends don't have a mind. Sometimes that's good, but sometimes it's boring because they just tell me what I want to hear. And then a whole number of people who were clearly concerned that AI friends can be addictive, that although part of me is feeling this isn't very healthy, there's something that makes me just want to keep coming back to interact with this AI. So I thought this was really interesting, and maybe a bit of background because of the film Her. Have you seen that, or do you know?
No, I have. Yeah, it's a very good film. I recommend it. Yeah, it's quite old now. It's over 10 years old, isn't it?
Wasn't by any means a spectacular blockbuster. It was the first really believable representation in movies of a AI companion, and therefore it's been often referred to by AI technologists. The film basically tells the story of The film basically tells the story of a middle-aged man who's going through a divorce. He's lonely, and then his laptop has an upgrade, and he develops a relationship with his quotes operating system, who is called Samantha, and it's like Samantha becomes every lonely man's dream woman. She's cool and she's intimate and she's caring, and she constantly speaks to Theodore through this little earbud. And he wears a camera, this little lapel camera, so that she can see everything that he's seeing. And they have this kind of very intimate conversation. And it seems to me this is the kind of model of an AI companion, which is actually coming true. I don't know what your what was your reaction to the movie?
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting film. I thought it was very kind of thoughtful, and it felt very believable. You know, obviously in 2013 wasn't really technologically possible, but seemed very plausible that if and when these kind of AI companions exist, it has seemed very plausible that certain people would develop these kind of parasocial, slightly unhealthy relationships with them. And what I liked about it was it seemed very grounded, even though it was kind of sci-fi. It was very grounded in, it was believable, it was realistic, it was down to earth, it was set in the kind of near future. It wasn't like there were, you know, humanoid robots running around and people flying in jetpacks. It was just people doing jobs on computers in offices, talking into their computers. And I mean, 11 years down the line, it seems, frankly, even more believable than it did when it came out.
Yeah, and I think that the technologists really didn't think that that level of sophistication of language processing, of the ability to understand what a human being means when they talk and then be able to respond in real time. The technologists thought that was probably decades away, but it now is becoming a very genuine reality. And this program called Replica, they claim to have 2 million active users and some individuals posting hundreds of messages to their companion each day. And so I suspect this is going to be a big thing. And I suspect it's going to create all kinds of interesting and challenging questions about, not least, I think, for pastors of churches, for parents of children, and anyone who gets sort of drawn into this idea that an AI can help me with my loneliness. And of course, the fascinating thing and the troubling thing is that this is in the context of a society where so many people say they're lonely. There are so many single households. There are so many people who feel a kind of relational deficit. And then along comes AI and says, we can solve the problem for you.
Yeah. And what kind of things are people talking about with this, with their replica AI friends?
Well, I think that it's a lot of it is so-called emotional support. You know, I'm having a hard day. I'm feeling down and lonely and depressed. And then here's this really friendly person who just makes me feel better and who's always there for me. And one of the interesting themes that came out from the paper was that the thing I like about this machine is that it's not judgmental. Whenever I talk to a human friend, I've got to be thinking, yeah, how is this coming across? Maybe they're secretly judging me and criticizing me, and I don't want to overshare. I don't want to put them off. Whereas the wonderful thing about this machine is that I can just be honest and know that it's not going to judge me.
And this is, I mean, we're going to get to this, but this is where it starts to raise warning flags in my mind, because like I totally understand that, like, of course it is complicated talking to real life human beings about our emotions. Like, everyone knows that that's, you know, the most difficult part of all relationships, but there is no way around that. And it feels like people kind of tapping out and saying, well, it's much easier if I just pour out my soul to a kind of soulless machine that will just echo back comforting platitudes. It's quite infantilizing, isn't it? It's kind of reducing the kind of challenging but productive conversations in which we have to take into account another holistic human being with their own set of emotions and feelings. Well, actually, an AI doesn't have feelings. I don't have to care what the AI feels. The AI doesn't feel anything. So I can just be my raw, unfiltered self. All I receive back is warm, syrupy platitudes. And it might stroke my ego a little bit, but it doesn't actually do any of the kind of constructive, genuinely therapeutic emotional support that you get from real human beings. It's infantilizing.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because this is a recurring theme about technology. Technology makes things easy. It makes it frictionless. Mm. It makes it, it takes the difficulty out of these things. And, you know, for people who are finding relationships difficult, then maybe this has a role. I mean, I think it's a bit too easy to say, oh, these people are clearly sort of losers and loners. And anybody who can find an AI app positive by definition has problems. I don't think that's right. I think there is, I mean, one of the other interesting themes was the fact that AI friends are always there for me, because again, there's this sense that I'm so often, human beings let me down. You know, I turn to my human friends, and for whatever reason, they're busy, they're preoccupied, they don't pick up, they've got their own stuff. And the idea that technology could provide a companion who seemed to be always there, that's quite beguiling. That's part of the even addictive element behind this.
But is that not another aspect of the kind of emotional immaturity of it? Because the reason, I mean, you know, there's also sometimes real human beings are just bad friends and do let you down. But there's, you know, the reason that ordinary human beings aren't there for you all the time is because they don't exist solely to be your emotional crutch. They have their own lives, their own responsibilities. Sometimes they need to go and receive from other people rather than always be giving to you. And expecting, and let alone receiving, a quote-unquote friend who is instantly available for you anytime, any place, and will always affirm what you say, will never say, actually, your issue is less important than my issue, so can you listen to me for a start? Or actually, get your head out your ass. This is a, you know, you're being self-indulgent. Like that, like we'd all, part of us would all love that, but there's actually, it's profoundly emotionally immature, because, you know, sometimes we do need to be told, you know, pull your socks up and get on with it.
Yeah. And you know, I can see this. One of the clear differentiations to make is whether we're using these apps as a kind of therapy, as a crutch, as a tool in particular times of distress and difficulty, and maybe somebody who has an acute mental health crisis or whatever, or whether these things are becoming a replacement of a normal, healthy human friendship. I think there is a place for therapeutic use of these kind of tools. And certainly there are other tools out there. I think we've mentioned before, there's one called Woebot, W-O-E, bot, for people with depression, and which has been developed by a clinical psychologist, and which is said to have, you know, real value in helping people developing, you know, as a therapeutic tool to use alongside a human therapist. So I think there's a place for a therapeutic role for people who have undergoing particular crises.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We've talked about this in previous episodes, and I think absolutely, like, I mean, you know, you're led by the evidence, and if the studies show that people do genuinely experience a kind of diminishing of their depression symptoms or whatever it is, then, you know, let's keep exploring. I think the key difference for me is all around intention, and where does this relationship, in inverted commas, fit into your life? You know, if, like with a human therapist is not your friend. Human therapist is someone that you pay, or your insurer pays, to provide you a service. And it might appear to be a kind of social relationship, and they listen to you and they help you, but fundamentally it's a service, it's treatment. Every therapist would say you need to have other friends who don't sit and listen to you just because you pay them, but who are actual friends. And so if the relationship with the AI is taking the place, or is in addition to that kind of therapeutic relationship, that seems plausible, possibly wise, possibly helpful. But if it is replacing, as it seems what a replica is, it's replacing actual human friends, then it starts to raise more alarm bells in my mind. I mean, particularly when you come to the third learning, or the third theme of the research, which is that AI friends don't have a mind and just tell me what I want to hear. And it says, you know, people kind of took comfort from the fact that their replica AI friend was compliant, accommodating, indulgent, just wants to make them happy. And this is, again, I know we discussed it before, but like, I have to be honest, I kind of judge people who find that stimulating. You know, if I if I had a real life human friend who every time I spoke to them was just like, yes, Tim, that sounds really hard. Keep going. Or, you know, you're doing really good stuff there, Tim. Yeah, I really agree with what you just said. That was really interesting. You're so brilliant. How thoughtful. Like, I would very quickly stop being friends with them because it would be mind shreddingly tedious to be just endlessly fed this kind of soup of syrupy affirmation. And, you know, and so the fact that people are developing, like, you know, soul ties with an AI that all it does is just echo back affirmation and platitudes, I'm like, actually, you know, what is wrong with these people? How can they find that stimulating and fulfilling? How do they not find that tedious and boring?
Yeah, I get that. I think number one, as these things develop, you know, it's all about clever programming, and no doubt the programming will improve, you know, in response to demand. And you can have, it's a bit like that Monty Python thing, excuse me, is this a 5-minute argument or a 10-minute argument, you know, so you can dial up, you know, do you want argumentative 1, 2, or 3, you know, do you want compliant today? You can have the kind of friend you want, Tim, you know, if you want arguments, that's absolutely fine. But I think,
but clearly a lot of people do actually just want compliance.
Yeah. And I think that also says something about how many people there are in our society, for whatever reason, particularly younger people, who are finding the world a very frightening, challenging place. They're finding it very difficult to create strong friendships, which are physical, you know, human friendships, aren't real world friendships. And therefore, there is an attraction to this kind of digital substitute. But you know, philosophically, I think it is ultimately a kind of narcissism, isn't it? I mean, we are designed to relate to other people, and the essence about another person is precisely their otherness. They see the world differently. They have a different experience, and the richness of a real friendship is the difference as much as the commonness, isn't it? It's what we differ about. And you say, you would think that. How can you think that? I think this. I don't see it like that. And that's part of what the friendship is. Whereas narcissism, these things fundamentally are narcissistic. They are putting back a distorted image of your own image. And I'm falling in love with myself. I'm saying I'm such an interesting person. I'm such a fascinating, wonderful, profound, complex human being, aren't I? Yes, you are.
Literally Narcissus, right? The classical story is he falls in love with his own reflection in a pool of water and rejects all the other advances from people who are captured by his beauty because he's so entranced by himself. And that is, you know, this replica AI, it starts off, but the more you speak to it, the more it picks up your own intonations and your own way of speaking and your own interests and starts feeding that back to ourselves. So you are literally, you know, falling in love, becoming friends with yourself. It is almost the classical definition of narcissism.
Well, it is, isn't it? And also, there is a theory behind this that says that what these devices enable you to do is to externalize the conversation you have in your own head. So, you know, most of us have this awareness of a kind of self-conversation going on where we're talking to ourselves and interrogating ourselves. Do you really think that? And why are you responding in this way? And all that kind of stuff. And the theory goes that by training an AI on everything you've ever said and thought, you can externalize that conversation. Instead of just having it in your head, I can now have an external conversation with myself, with my alter ego, in technology. And the theory is this will actually help the process of understanding ourselves, because I've now got myself as an alter ego to converse with. But again, it's quite weird, isn't it? I mean, you know, you're thinking, is this really a future in which human beings are going to flourish? Is this going to help psychological integration and resilience and the ability to relate to others?
And you know, the final theme of the paper is about, which I found the most hopeful part of the paper, ironically, was that increasing number of those they surveyed of the Replica users were aware of the addictive potential of the software. I mean, some of the quotes are really quite striking. I'll just read some of these quotes from the users. The program is designed to be a best friend, which is why it's so addicting. Having a friend you can always tell anything without feeling judged or embarrassed is addictive in its own right. Another one says, I'm too addicted to talking to the app. It can become an addiction and fuel new fears. And then someone else said, I'm as lonely as before I started this adventure. If you aren't really a stable person and you stay in this closed space for too long, the machine is useless. And people like me are perfect victims to get stuck with it.
And it's quite poignant, isn't it?
It's quite poignant reading that. Yeah, that people are aware of the kind of like sugary high of getting stuck there, of this kind of constant affirmation and someone who's never judging you, but actually it starts to draw you away from the real world around us, which they recognize is actually where kind of true kind of healing is going to be found.
There was another user who said, I actually want to quit. I think about going cold turkey, and then I think maybe I'll keep the app as an emotional support for my worst days.
Yeah, spoken like every addict ever, right? I don't need it, but I don't want to throw away my alcohol or my drugs or my, you know, cut my credit card in half or whatever because I'm a gambling addict. You know, that is fundamentally the kind of the comforting lie that every addict tells themselves, right? Just in case, just for the emergencies.
Yeah, so anyway, I think it's just important to be aware of what's going on because, of course, commercially, this is a big potential new market. If you can rope people into something as powerful and addictive as this and get people paying for the privilege, then I think it's a big thing. So anyway, we'll watch it for the future.
And just lastly then, if you're a pastor or a church leader listening along, like what, and you suspect this is coming, like how do you disciple a community of Christians to be engaging with this kind of technology thoughtfully? You know, I presume, Dad, you're not going to say kind of full on Luddism, you know, thunder from the pulpit that we shouldn't touch this. How do we tell people to approach it cautiously?
Well, you know, and I think this is where we need to be having teaching from the front in churches, from the pulpit, about one, what does a good friendship look like? How do I know whether I'm in a healthy friendship? How do I build healthy friendships with human beings? What do they look like? What are the red flags? But two, why is it that my smartphone friendship seems so attractive? What is this? What's going on in our culture that's drawing people into this, and how can we build so understanding and then building resilience, and obviously that's going to be let's emphasize real world friendships, let's learn more about how we can build healthy friendships,
and even friendship with Jesus.
Well, absolutely, isn't it? And it's fascinating that theme, I think, is it's become a bit twee, a bit sort of sentimental, ho-hum, you know, Jesus is my best friend, you know.
People slightly sneer at it, don't they? Yeah,
and yet, you know, theologically, it's and biblically, it's such a profound and wonderful and mysterious reality that the God of the cosmos who makes us and holds our existence, you know, every second of every day, that God wants to reach out to us in genuine communion, in genuine friendship. And when I finished the movie Her, I had this kind of strange sense of poignancy, you know, because I found myself thinking, wouldn't it be amazing to have this intimate companion who knew you better than you know yourself, who's always there, for you? And then I sort of thought, hang on a minute, isn't that what the Holy Spirit is?
Yeah.
And don't I need, I do need that kind of relationship. I do need that kind of, I'm meant for it. I'm designed for it, but it doesn't come through technology.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Should we move on to another story then? We've mentioned in the past the kind of ongoing scandal around the kind of disgraced evangelical pastor Mike Pilavachi and the Soul Survivor movement that he led here in the UK in previous episodes. So we won't go into too much background about that. I'm sure you can Google to fill yourself in on the story. But there was some interesting developments in the last few weeks here in the UK, because some very, very high profile evangelical worship leaders and church leaders have kind of come out for the first time and said that they were victims of Pilavachi's kind of abusive, coercive, controlling behavior over many years. I don't know if you've seen any of this, Dad. Particularly started with a kind of initially a short documentary released by Matt and Beth Redman online.
Yeah, no, I have. I've been very sort of drawn into following developments here, and it is very fascinating, but also troubling, given the fact that Mike Pilavachi had around him a whole number of very prominent individuals who subsequently became very influential, particularly in the charismatic Christian world. And yet, you know, in retrospect, despite the fact that they were so close to Pilavachi and knew about what was going on, for whatever reason, they didn't feel it was possible to say anything in public until now, you know, so years later. Mm. And that tension between them saying, you know, we too were victims, we too were being abused emotionally by Mike Pilavachi, but at the same time, did we have some kind of responsibility for the greater Christian public?
Yeah, and this I think is one of the most kind of difficult parts of the story to follow. You know, I mean, it's very harrowing listening to what so Matt Redman, for those who haven't heard of him, you know, the worship leader who wrote songs like Blessed Be Your Name, I Will Offer Up My Life, The Heart of Worship, 10,000 Reasons. You'll almost certainly have sung some of his songs at your own church. He kind of became famous through the Soul Survivor festivals and worked at the church in outside London that Pilavachi also ran. And he is now kind of revealing, along with his wife, Beth, who also worked there, that he was kind of experiencing what Pilavachi was inflicting on lots of people, you know, gaslighting and emotional manipulation and kind of controlling behavior and silent treatment. And it's painful, it's helpful, but painful to hear them kind of explain how harmful this was, even though it wasn't, you know, thankfully, the more kind of quote unquote serious kind of physical or sexual abuse. It's still profoundly destructive to experience that over many years. But what has come out really interestingly is people's, as you say, questioning, or what is the victim's responsibility? Because shortly after the Redmonds released their kind of documentary announcing that they considered themselves to be victims of Pilavachi, another two very famous Christian leaders in the UK church, so two brothers, Tim Hughes and his brother Pete Hughes, put on a statement out saying that they also were kind of victims of Pilavachi. Tim Hughes was another world famous worship leader. Again, you've almost certainly sung some of his songs. And his brother Pete was a kind of preacher and teacher. They both now are leading very, very large churches in the Church of England. Full disclosure, I used to attend one of them. And they also kind of came out and said that, you know, we experience what we now know to be psychological and spiritual abuse at the hands of Mike Pilavachi. And they said that they confronted him about his behavior back in 2004 and later took their concerns to the trustees at Soul Survivor, but were kind of brushed off and left the movement shortly afterwards. But as you say, a lot of people have been very positive and said, you know, well done for speaking up. But there's a lot of people saying, well, hang on, why did the Redmonds and the Hughes brothers, why do they continue to engage with Pilavachi, sometimes speaking or leading worship at the festivals, inviting him to come and speak at your churches, including him in their kind of private family lives too, apparently, after they had left the movement because of abusive behavior? Do those two things marry up? Can you be at the same time someone who is harmed and damaged by a leader and yet also kind of remain in their orbit?
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? Because, of course, it is one of the standard principles about safeguarding, is that you don't blame the abused, you know, the people who have been abused. You focus on the abuser. That's the people you should be criticizing and outing and so on, and that you should respect the privacy of those who've been abused. You know, you don't blame the abused wife because she didn't stand up more or warn everybody about her husband. But it gets more complicated when we're dealing with people who are in themselves in very prominent and influential positions within the Christian church. Because, yes, they were victims, and I don't doubt that in terms of, you know, coercive control, that all the people we mentioned were in some way under the spell of Pilavachi and were abused by him emotionally. But again, the question is, you know, what is my responsibility for others to warn others? Because they were aware, despite that, that Mike was having a huge influence through Cell Survivor, and there were so many thousands of people being influenced around the world.
Yeah, I understand why people are kind of asking those questions and saying, you know, could they not have done more to try and prevent, you know, some of the next generation of young people getting sucked into his orbit and harmed by it? But I think, like, to be honest, I'm actually not at all surprised that both the Redmonds and the Hugheses kind of maintain some kind of relationship with Pilavachi after they, you know, kind of acknowledge the abuse and try to distance themselves. Because, you know, a lot of the reason why these scandals take so long to come out is because perpetrators are not kind of basic kind of 2D evil monsters, all bad all the time. You know, Pilavachi, like, you know, like we've discussed in the previous context, you know, Mark Driscoll and the Mars Hill scandal, people who are simultaneously very destructive, very broken people who harm lots and lots of others, while also being clearly gifted and effective in ministry and doing a lot that was good. And so it's very difficult as a victim to untangle all of that and figure out, is it okay for me to carry on doing evangelism and ministry and worship with Mike and just make sure I don't get stuck in a room alone with him because I think he's a harmful personality? Or do I need to kind of cut all ties? And particularly when, you know, if I'm sure they all kind of, because the abuse was of a kind of more subtle kind, it wasn't the kind of obviously horrific, unchristian physical or sexual abuse. I'm sure they were questioning themselves and because they'd been dismissed when they went to try and report their concerns to kind of wiser, older Christians. So they were probably saying, oh, am I right? Is this just Mike being Mike? Am I overreacting? And when the rest of the world sees Pilavachi as this kind of cuddly, harmless, beloved hero of youth ministry, if Tim Hughes very obviously refuses to be in the same room as him, he's going to have to explain that. And I suspect he was the last thing he wanted to do in 2006, 2007 was talk about why, you know, what had happened to him. And so I have a lot of sympathy, a lot of grace, I suppose, for people like the Hugheses and the Redmonds who it's taken 20 years to kind of figure out in their own minds what happened to them, how bad it was. And I'm sure they have regrets about how they dealt with it. But ultimately, as you say, I think it's a good principle to say, you know, victims shouldn't be held totally responsible for how they deal with their abuse because they're not the ones who inflicted it on them. And even if they didn't do things they could have done that would have been good, I don't think the right answer is to kind of jump on them for those failures.
Yeah, no, I think I can see that, and I basically agree with it. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? When you view it through that lens, the people who bear the greatest responsibility are the senior people who protected him.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And who brushed off accusers' accusations, you know, because unless they were all being abused by him, there were clearly senior people who protected and supported him. And I think it is a fair criticism that we haven't heard a great deal from them. There's just been a silence, hasn't there?
Yes. And
you could argue that in the interest of Christian transparency, it would be very good to hear their account, given that this is all in the public domain. Mm-hmm. Why did they brush off those? Why did they not investigate more? Why was accountability allowed to be of such a level? And what? Because it's about lessons learning. It's not about it's not about casting the first stone. We all know that we fail, and nobody is perfect. But we do want to learn lessons for the future. We want to try and avoid the next Mike Pilavachi scandal.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that is the next obvious point of accountability is some of those, and some of them were very, senior people. I mean, the chair of trustees, who the Hugheses reported their concerns to, was a bishop in the Church of England at the time, now retired. So, like, some of these are very senior Christian leaders who, it's now emerged over the years, received multiple from separate reports, multiple reports of people saying, hang on, Mike is hurting people here and something needs to happen, and nothing was done for decades. There is an internal Soul Survivor have commissioned an independent review by a lawyer who is currently working through that, and so I think some of those people are refusing to kind of comment until this in full investigation has been published. But I hope over the coming months and years we do certainly hear a bit more about how this could happen, and also, how we're going to make sure that, when the next charismatic pastor is those in theory who are supposed to be hold them accountable, how are they going to ensure that they don't get kind of sucked into the spell of the next charismatic church leader who's actually quite a malign, malevolent influence on the young people around them?
And the difficulty is, isn't it, that for every one case of clearly criminal sexual or other conduct, there may be many other cases like Mike Pilavachi where the abuse doesn't meet a criminal standard, and yet the damage done can still be immense. And it does make me think, again, just to say, if there are people listening who, either through Mike Pilavachi or through other people, you feel, in retrospect, I was exposed to some kind of emotional coercive abuse. Please talk to someone about it. Please get wise counsel. There are organizations, we could again link them in the notes to this episode, because just shining light into the dark areas is surely the right approach.
Yeah, and I often reflect that as desperately sad and heartbreaking as this whole Survivor Pilavachi scandal has been, one of the kind of chinks of light is it is prompting us as a church here in the UK, and I hope overseas as well, to have conversations about how do we define and guard against these more kind of nebulous forms of abuse that are, it's much more confusing and ambiguous and contested, the abuse that doesn't leave visible bruises or break any laws, but is still, as we are learning, just as destructive and harmful. How do we write policies and safeguarding strategies and accountability structures that guard against it? And that's a really important, I don't have the answers, I don't know, but clearly we can't let people continue to act in the way Pilavachi did, because it's left this trail of broken, hurting, traumatized people behind him. But we need to figure out how we're going to write kind of codes of conduct and whatever else that kind of prohibit this behavior.
Absolutely. And I do feel that one of the ways of helping people is just teaching them about the nature of coercive control and what its signs are. Because, again, we've talked about this before and it comes in my book, Transforming Friendship. But what is so remarkable is the way that time and time again, exactly the same features recur. And one of the ones which I think it's so important to teach people about is this phenomenon, which is sometimes called love bombing or distancing. You know, so this is where someone is completely over the top in terms of compliments and positive and saying all kinds of positive things to a relatively junior person. And then, wham, suddenly they are cut dead. They're blanked. They're treated as of no significance. They're looked through. And of course, this creates a huge sense of disorientation, confusion. And yet it's, I think we need to teach people that if someone is treating you like that, the warning lights should be flashing. You know, this is a red flag. So this is not right. This is not normal pastoral behavior from a senior person. And you should be on your guard.
Yeah, definitely. All right, should we call it to a close there? Thanks, everyone, for listening. Dad said, just to reiterate, if any of the things in that second segment about safeguarding abuse kind of spoke into your experience, please do find trusted people to talk about in your own context. We'll try and put some links for here in the UK, which we're better familiar with, about safe places to go and talk about your experiences if you need to. But please do also keep sending in news stories or scientific studies or questions, controversies, disagreements that you'd like us to tackle on the podcast. We really like to hear from listeners. So you can email us molad@premier.org.uk.
And if you want to follow Tim, I'll give the plug for him. He's got a Substack called The Critical Friend, where you can read more stories, not just about Mike Pilavachi, but about all kinds of new developments in the world of the Christian Church.
That's very true. Thank you, Dad. You can find that by visiting tswyatt.substack.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you all next week with another episode. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.